Support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Tracy Ray from the employment law firm of Baron Liebman. Tracy says that OPB sponsorship is a great way to support the community and connect with Baron Liebman's clients.
From the Gert Boyle studio at OPB, this is Think Out Loud. I'm Dave Miller. According to recent reporting from Eugene Weekly, at least 9 University of Oregon students were drugged at fraternity parties since the beginning of this year. What's more, the paper found that the university failed to alert students about what was happening, violating their own protocols. Eliza Aronson is a senior at the University of Oregon studying journalism and marine biology. She's been covering this issue as an intern for Eugene Weekly, and she joins us now. Eliza, welcome.
Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Let's start with the first incident that folks have been writing about. What have you been able to learn about what happened on January 19th?
Yeah, so this incident actually wasn't the first incident to happen, but this is the one that we have UO Police Department notification form about. And so what we know from that event is that the Eugene Police Department responded to 2 female students who were reportedly, you know, out of it outside an unknown fraternity that night. The boyfriends of the 2 women were contacted and they took them to a private residence where EPD and medical assistance showed up. And those 2 women were then transferred to Mackenzie Willamette Medical Center for further treatment. And so basically what we know is that the Eugene Police Department responded initially, and then the next morning called the U of O Police Department and notified them of the event.
What have you been able to learn about other alleged incidents?
So the only other incident where I have, you know, information on really is the one that happened at a Phi Del live out. I think that happened early February, and the information that I know from this event is because of other student reporting and interviews that other student publications have done. So this event happened at a live out, which is basically a private residence where fraternity or in other instances, sorority members, you know, own a private residence, like rent out a private residence. But it's all, you know, chapter members that live there. And so 2 freshman women went to a party. Someone who they trusted at the time gave them a drink, you know, and the quote that we used was, you know, it was less than half a solo cup. So not a lot of alcohol. And within 30 or so minutes, the women were throwing up, super dizzy. Thankfully, they had a 3rd friend who was able to get them both home safely, but they woke up the next morning still really sick. And so that's the only incident that I know about. And we reported about that and the coverage of that in my first story, Blackout, which came out, I think, a month before this most recent story.
Just to take a step back, are there any estimates of the prevalence of these kinds of druggings on college campuses around the country?
Yeah. So when I was, you know, writing out the story, I wanted that statistic and I was looking for it, but it's really actually kind of hard to find a perfect cut and dry statistic of that because one, I mean, like if you've read my previous coverage, you know that the UO Health Center doesn't have drug tests for Rohypnol, which is often used for druggings. And, you know, Rohypnol it's tasteless, it's odorless, and it leaves the body within 72 hours. The hospital Riverbend also doesn't have tests for Rohypnol. And so it's really hard for students to figure out if they'd been drugged or not, you know, to get that confirmation and clarification. And so I haven't been able to find a perfect statistic to kind of cover that. A couple of years ago, there's survey data of, you know, around 6,000 students at 3 universities. And they found that more than 1 in 13 students have been reported to being drugged. But realistically, I'm not too sure of how prevalent this is.
You pointed out in your articles that drugging somebody without their knowledge is a felony in Oregon. But it seemed like you got the runaround when you asked Eugene police and university police about this. What happened?
So originally from student reporting about the Fidel live out incident, I was told that the two women had filed a Eugene police report. And so I reached out to them and they immediately referred me to UO Communications. And when I asked why, they said that the UO Police Department was covering the incident and investigating. Then I reached out to the UVO Police Department. And when I spoke to them, they said they had no idea about any reports and they weren't investigating. After I published that first story, it came out that, in fact, the Eugene Police Department was indeed investigating that incident. The Daily Emerald, which is the student newspaper, student-run newspaper, they broke that story.
What are universities required to do in terms of disclosure for these kinds of incidents under federal law?
Yeah, so the federal law that kind of covers all of this, it's called the Clery Act. And so one of the requirements of the Clery Act is that universities keep a daily crime log. And so basically anyone from the public can access these records and see what crimes are being reported and where they happened in, you know, locations either on campus or around or surrounding the campus. You know, the requirement is that these logs are kept up to date. And just because something's in the log, you know, they're not required to investigate, but it should be, you know, you should be able to go on the log and see an incident and know where it happened and when it happened.
Did the university do that?
No. when we look at the logs, there is one incident of ingesting substances without knowing that you were ingesting substances. And that was on January 15th. However, the location is listed at Unthink Hall, which is a dorm on campus. And that's not actually where the drugging happened. That's just where it was reported. And so, you know, that's not how it should be. It's useless to, you know, have a crime listed where it didn't happen. But the rest of the drugging incidences do not show up in the logs.
We reached out to the university in advance of this conversation. They sent us a long statement. I want to read part of it here. The university, they wrote, took the reports of alleged drugging seriously. Our Office of Student Conduct issued an interim suspension that ceased all operations of the organizations connected with the reports, including social events. We then publicized information about each suspension on our website and shared information through various channels, including with the fraternity and sorority life community. The reports were also shared with the UO Interfraternity Council, which elected to issue a moratorium on alcohol at social events. No additional reports of druggings have been received. What's your response to that paragraph?
So I guess first off, the website they're referring to is a chapter status website, basically where they will show, you know, all the different fraternity and sorority chapters on campus and if they're suspended or not. And so on that website, the only information they have posted is that these three fraternities, Delta Sigma Phi, Phi Delta Theta, and Theta Chi, are under interim suspension. So if you go on that website, you can see that these fraternities are under suspension, but it gives no indication why they are suspended. So nowhere on that page is it saying that these fraternities are under suspension for alleged druggings. And also that.
So when they say we then publicize information about each suspension on our website, you're saying, but that didn't include the reasons for those suspensions. And it could have been any kind of behavior infraction.
Right. Yeah. So when you look at this website, it's just saying the date of action and action taken, interim suspension. So there's no details about why the suspension happened.
How long was it from the time that the university had credible information about alleged druggings, a series of them, to when they said anything to the broader student community about these reports?
So we got, as like a student, we got a spring campus advisory email, and that was, I think I counted the days, that was 94 days after the first incident of druggings. And so this, you know, this email came out to us, and it had information about, you know, make sure you lock your bikes up and make sure you charge your phone before going out. And, you know, that was 94 days after the first drugging. And so, and actually in comparison, I think yesterday we actually got a timely warning notification of a literal dumpster fire. And, you know, that shows up in our emails as you owe timely warning, and said Eugene fire. And so that went out. I think that was a timely warning about a fire in a dumpster that happened, I think, early morning. And we got that within 24 hours.
But it took them almost 100 days to say explicitly that there had been reports of druggings of students.
Yes. Correct.
And am I right that that was after you as a journalist had submitted questions to them and it was clear that this was going to become a bigger story?
Yeah. So that I got that email of the spring advisory, I think 3 days after I sent the UVO a number of questions about, you know, what action they had taken. And the UO communications woman I was speaking to pointed out, she was like, she must have looked me up. She says, as a student, you should have received this email. And I then was like, yeah, I'm like, let's count the days of how long I had to wait for this email.
What are the various ways that the university defended its months-long silence?
So the first thing they told me was that in an email, UO Communications spokesperson Angela Sedell said that drugging itself is not a clearly reportable crime. And that's not true, you know, stated in the federal law. And that's not true, actually, what the UVO defines. And then their next argument was that all these incidences happened outside clearly reportable geography. And so the Clery Act, you know, it covers anything on actual campus, but then it also covers specific locations outside of campus. So it's called off-campus geography. And that counts anything that, you know, is run by a student organization. So that counts as, you know, fraternity chapter houses. And they said none of those incidences happened at fraternity houses. They happened at liveouts. You know, I have a text from Eric Howald, who is also from UO Communications, saying directly that all the incidences happened at liveouts, making them not within Clery geography. They also said that, you know, they did education and outreach with, you know, fraternity members. And then the last statement they sent me was that sending out a warning may mislead people to believe that campuses are less safe than they actually are, may provoke panic, and may reinforce racial stereotypes. The statement they sent me also said, additionally, these notifications may be perceived as victim blaming, can expose the identity of victims who report crime, trigger retaliation, re-traumatize victims of past crime, and cause chilling effects on crime reporting. So basically, they're saying that sending out a timely warning would have had negative effects, and, you know, caused, you know, all these effects. So they constantly kept telling me things, excuses why they didn't send out these timely warnings.
I want to run one more quote by you from the statement that they gave us. They said this: "We reject the assertion made by Ms. Aronson that the university was untruthful in the information it provided and are disappointed that the Eugene Weekly article selectively quotes, omits, and misrepresents aspects of the university's response. What is your response to that?
My response is I've been sending so many emails and phone calls with the U of O, I would have had to work really hard to change the story that they were giving me. You know, I don't want to be reporting this story. This is my school, and it's unfortunate that I'm having to report about the bad decisions that they're making. I would much rather not be writing this story, but, you know, they're giving me no choice. I want my school to be protecting us and to be doing the right thing, and they're not.
Just briefly, you also point out that even the interim suspensions of some fraternity activities were not as strong as they might seem. What do you mean?
So basically, the interim suspension, the fraternities aren't supposed to, you know, be able to hold sponsored activities, and they've, you know, lost privileges with the university. But the Daily Emerald broke on April 3rd that the Associate Dean of Students has been lifting sanctions, you know, to accommodate events sponsored by the fraternities. So they're able to hold dad's weekends, and they're also, you know, able to do new recruitment, new member recruitment, hold, I think, chapter executive meetings. And I think one email we got showed that the Associate Dean of Student was even, you know, considering letting one of the fraternities have their formal event. And so there's so many exceptions that are being allowed on these interim suspensions that they don't really feel like true suspensions and true consequences.
Eliza, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Eliza Aronson is an intern right now at the Eugene Weekly. She is a senior at the University of Oregon studying marine biology and journalism.
If you tune in to Think Out Loud because you love learning about what's happening in our region, you'll love listening to The Evergreen. This weekly podcast paints an audio portrait of the Pacific Northwest through the stories of the people who live here. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.